Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it's Saturday morning. Bright, well, it's actually not quite bright yet. I'm again suffering from some jet lag, but I tell you, it was a really fantastic experience to just get out of the house and go and meet interesting people and have some really educational experiences in Saudi Arabia. And honestly, I didn't know that I'd been feeling like a caged bird until I got outside and onto a plane and off again. So it was certainly both a tiring but a very refreshing experience. And I do feel very grateful to have been invited to the Futures Minerals Summit because it was certainly an eye-opening experience. I've never had my preconceptions about any country threatened. Or I think confounded would probably be the better word, than I have visiting Saudi Arabia. The preconceptions that people tend to have, and I've certainly been guilty of it, were certainly challenged. I met lots of very enthusiastic, optimistic, articulate young people, both male and female. And they've been given responsibility. There's a large number of young graduates were hired by the government, and they were given the responsibility to organize this event. And I think they did an admirable job, particularly when it was their first one. So I thought that was also particularly interesting. The other thing I think most people don't realize is that a lot of Saudi Arabian people work hard for a living. There's this sort of perception that Saudi Arabia must be more like Dubai. And I've been to Dubai on several occasions and other parts of the Middle East, and you would very rarely meet an Emirati in just daily discourse. But the reality is, in Saudi Arabia, you're meeting Saudis everywhere. And I felt very welcomed by everybody I met, whether that was at the summit or just traveling around the city, just seeing the sights. And they are certainly trying to build up their international reputation as a place to do business. And I think it's an interesting development from a global perspective, because we've been talking for years about a multipolar world. And that multipolar world has, in many respects, been thought of in terms of the competition between the USA and China. But perhaps that's not how everybody sees it. I think it is more likely, in fact, that what Saudi Arabia is attempting to do is to become a central hub for both industrialization and the exploitation of natural resources, and that it's going to try and inspire better standards of governance and and then mining and oil exploration right in its backyard, whether that's up into Central Asia or down into Africa. And then, of course, it has very close proximity to a growing economy like India. So I thought it was particularly interesting to listen to the CEO of Vedanta, which of course is an Indian mining company, comparing his experience and the way that he's built his business and dealing with the evolution of demand for copper in India versus, for example, some of the other mining CEOs. And it couldn't be more different. So I think those are some of the interesting things that we'll talk about. But I think we also need to pay attention to what's happening in terms of money supply, because I thought this was an interesting chart. I often look at the total assets of central banks, but it's equally important to pay attention to global money supply, because it is up from about 25 trillion in 2003 to 100 trillion right now. And this trend is still underway. Now, of course, we had an epic acceleration in the supply of money in 2020, and it was inevitable that the pace of that advance couldn't be sustained. And we've certainly seen a slowdown in the pace of the advance over the course of the last 9 months. But the trend is still positive, which means that global money supply is still positive and growing, and that's a support for asset prices. Now, we can also think about this in terms of when this measure starts to contract. Well, it contracted in 2008. Money supply evaporated during the credit crisis, but it also contracted after the end of QE1 in 2010. And then we had another contraction in 2014 and a difficult period for stock markets as well between 2015 and 16. And then in 2018, we also had a couple of wobbles in the stock market. We had the 10% pullback around the time that Jay Powell was inaugurated, and then we had a 20% pullback at the end of the year. And that 20% pullback chastened the Fed, and they started printing again. They stopped raising interest rates, and we were already in a loosening cycle by the time the pandemic hit, and then they accelerated their policies so that we saw money supply jump by 25% in the space of a year. And of course, that has helped to inflate asset prices for absolutely everything. And then it's worth considering that that's a 100 trillion figure. So if we then look at the total assets of central banks, let me see if I can put this over here, we can also see the acceleration in 2020. We can see another acceleration in 2008. So this is a graphic representation of the era of quantitative easing. So we can then conclude simply that about a third of all the money in existence is currently sitting on the central bank balance sheets of the major global central banks. And this trend is also still rising. So there's a lot of money that's still being printed. It's not being printed at the same pace as it was in 2020, but there is a lot of money floating around. Now, when we think about that in terms of how we might think of the global money supply and where does money flow to? Well, money and money creation is global and mobile, and it flows to the most attractive assets. So then the big question is, what's going to be the most attractive asset going forward? Are we going to continue to see the outperformance of technology prosper in this environment? And that is going to be very much tied to what we can see from both valuations and interest rates. But one thing that I think is particularly relevant to pay attention to is the continued performance of the eight largest companies. Because when you tabulate the market caps of the companies like Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, Apple, and Nvidia and Tesla, well, then you get this trend. And the trend has been underway for a decade. So when we think then about how have people been making money in the market, all you had to do was own those eight shares for the last decade and you did fine. Because the market cap of or the percentage of the total market cap of the US market that these companies represented jumped from about 7% to 23% in the space of less than a decade. But it's stopped rising, and we've had a significant correction over the course of the last while. So certainly there's a little bit of angst being expressed here. So one thing that we know is that money supply is increasing, and the rate at which it's increasing has moderated. And now we can also see that these FANG companies are underperforming. So the big question now is this simply a period of underperformance prior to a break higher, or is this the end of what has been a phenomenal period of outperformance for some of the largest companies in the world? Because we saw similar advances in terms of valuation, enthusiasm, and predictions, rosy predictions about the future in the late 1990s. The turn represented a peak for the dollar, a peak for technology, and the bottom of the commodity cycle. And all the money and credit that was created in the subsequent decade poured into emerging markets and commodities. And the abiding theme of the trend higher from the early 2000s was China's accession to the WTO, the activation of one of the largest populations in the world into the capitalistic system, and the massive investments in infrastructure that help to enable productivity growth for that young population. And that drove a massive bull market at exactly the same time that there was less interest in technology. And a lot of the reason for that was because of the dollar and because of the massive investment boom that had already taken place. Because the big boom in the 1990s was about building the internet. And by the time we got around to Y2K, the internet had been built. So after that, then a lot of the credit and had to be paid back. And then, of course, there were the shock events like the Nasdaq crash and 9/11, which resulted in massive money supply growth in the USA, and then debt appreciation without the productivity growth, which contributed to the evolution of the financial crisis. But the growth occurred in emerging markets and in commodities, and that was the abiding theme of that decade. Now we've had a phenomenal advance in technology shares, and we've seen valuations appreciate to really incredible levels, where we're seeing companies that don't have profits that are trading at price to sales ratios that are practically a lifetime to pay back. So they're very dependent on the flow of credit and the willingness to continue to support these shares is going to be pivotal. And I've been very clear in stating that I didn't believe that this bull market on Wall Street would end until these companies underperform. Now, we had a breakout in November, and it looked like this range that's been forming since 2020 was about to be resolved on the upside. But now that has failed, and it's coming back now to test the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, this is not the first time that that's happened. So we've had occasional periods when we've had downside surprises for these companies, and we may see another one, but it would be unusual to see another one in such close proximity to the last big decline. So it's certainly a sector that is worth paying attention to. So when we look at some of those companies like Amazon, well, the share has been going sideways for a year, and we've had a number of failed upside breaks. It's tried to push through the 3,500 level on a number of occasions, and each one of them has failed. Then the price pulled back below the 200-day moving average, and then it pulled back again on Thursday and steadied on Friday. So these types of companies have been magnets for liquidity, and because they occupy such significant weightings within their respective indices, then the evolution of the ETF industry has also concentrated money and capital within the shares of these companies. And Apple, for example, it is a company that has a massive moat in terms of its cash, and so does Google and Microsoft. So these companies, they're not likely to collapse. There's plenty of companies that are likely to collapse because if money and credit don't flow into them and they are running losses, well, eventually the money runs out. But those that have got business models that prosper in a global environment where growth is recovering, well, they should be okay. But that doesn't mean they have to be the best performers in the world. So what happens in terms of that ratio is certainly worth monitoring, because I think it's also relevant to look at the performance of the Nasdaq relative to oil. Now, this isn't a ratio that I've looked at a lot, but and we don't get to go back to the 1900s like we do with the Dow gold ratio. But there's no denying the fact that the Nasdaq peaked relative to oil in late 98, 99, and early 1999, and then began to trend lower. And the Nasdaq peaked relative to oil in early 2020, and we've seen a significant contraction underway for the last nearly 2 years. So obviously, the negative price environment for oil was a very significant psychological change for the market. I mean, can you imagine the experience of seeing the product that you sell going into a negative environment where you have oversupply and you're paying people to take it because you simply have nowhere to put it, and then turning around and being asked by the market to invest in additional supply, and at the same time, your entire industry is being vilified in the media because you're basically being accused of killing the planet. So it's not all that surprising that there is less money flowing into drilling new wells. And these companies aren't going to invest heavily in new supply. They're much more interested now in making money. So they're concentrating on cash flow. And they're going to try and contribute more money in terms of dividends and potentially share buybacks. So that's helping to support the industry. But it's now gone from a growth phase to what I think might arguably be called a utility phase. So when we look at the S&P 500 energy sector, well, it's broken higher over the course of the last week, and it's been trending higher for the last 2 years, and it's pushed back up above that 400 level and held it rather admirably. So this looks like a continued recovery. And we're potentially looking at a supply inelasticity environment, because if you're not investing in new supply, and the kinds of available shuttered supply are extremely carbon intensive, well, that's going to inhibit investment in additional new supply. When we think about the Canadian tar sands, they're extremely carbon intensive. So then we can think about the carbon credits market. And I think there's two ways of thinking about carbon credits. The first, of course, is that it is a politically contrived market. So it would not exist were it not for political sponsorship. And the pricing environment for carbon credits is clearly politically sponsored. I think that over time, these are going to fulfill some of the role that fixed income does in portfolios, because you have not just an implied but an actual government guarantee for their value, but you also get equity-like returns. And Europe wants to have the price around 100. They said they would have it. They wanted it around 100 about a year ago, and here we are. We're currently sitting at 93, and the price right now is 82, but it's been certainly getting up towards 100. And Europe has made the clear determination that they want to be energy independent. And that wasn't really an issue for Europe in the past, because the USA was the biggest consumer. It wasn't a point on which major countries competed. But because the USA is now an energy exporter, and that also means that their geopolitical priorities have changed. They obviously want to have security of supply, and they want to have a reasonably, they want to have a reasonably steady market for oil and gas. But they don't have quite the incentive to have low prices any longer. So I think this is a profound change. It also frees up their hand geopolitically because they're not reliant on imports in the same way that they would have been 20 years ago. So when we predicted in 2008 that the USA would become energy independent, that created a lot of blowback. And then by the time we got to 2015 and 16, and then people were saying, well, maybe the North America would become energy independent. And now we're looking at the reality that the USA is energy independent. And that has changed the geopolitical environment. And then we can think about Canada, that the pipelines have not been built, and it hasn't been able to boost export capacity down into the USA. And the tar sands are more expensive and more carbon intensive to manufacture or to produce from. The pre-salt in Brazil is extraordinarily deep offshore, and the offshore sector has gone through an extremely painful environment. Large numbers of the offshore companies have gone bust. And I think that this is obviously very much highlighting the fact that there's a clear advantage in having low-cost supply, because the world is going to need oil, and the energy transition isn't going to happen overnight to the extent that it happens at all. So just replacing 10% of global demand for oil is going to represent a profound change in mining. And this is obviously what the mining companies are salivating about. But I think it is interesting that when we think about the outlook for where money and capital are going to flow over the course of the next decade, well, the Nasdaq has been pulling back, and it's now in the region of the 200-day moving average. So we've had significant advances in the bubbly phase in the past, and then we've had big pullbacks and extraordinary volatility. But now we are right in the region of the upper side of the underlying range. This has been a reasonably consistent uptrend, with one range above another, periods of consolidation that have lasted for anywhere up to about a quarter. The peak was in November. We're now in January, and this is the place where support has to come back in. And it's possible because money supply is still increasing. But you're betting that a trend that's been underway for a decade already is going to persist, whereas the commodity prices are really only just beginning to break out. So I think it's also, I like this chart of the extremely long term for oil prices, because it helps to graphically illustrate the fact that commodity prices are based upon the rising marginal cost of production. So we get these extraordinarily lengthy ranges, and then they are resolved when you get supply and elasticity meeting rising demand. Well, we're potentially at a point where there's going to be supply inelasticity because the major producers aren't investing in new supply. And instead, they're looking at how they can limit their carbon exposure because of that politically driven ambition to have high carbon prices to make alternative solutions more competitive. And the rest of the world is looking at the Tesla and automotive sector experience, and everybody knows what happened to those companies. Tesla started building, and first they were the survivor. So Fisker went bust, and Tesla was able to monopolize the sale of carbon credits in California. So what that effectively meant was they were able to sell their carbon credits to the other automotive companies, use the proceeds to fund their growth. So effectively, they were using their competitors to fund their growth. And obviously, that is a circle that's extremely virtuous for Tesla, and it is a leeching effect on those other companies. So they have had to transition. They've been forced by regulation to abandon investment in sedan cars. So you have Ford, for example, that will no longer be producing sedans. They're going to focus on their trucks, and they've basically ceded the market for sedan vehicles to Tesla. And all of the automotive companies look at that kind of experience, and they're all transitioning. So that's going to imply less demand, and or at least less demand growth for oil over time. And this is obviously a very big issue for the oil companies, because predicting demand growth was the easier of the two trends. Predicting supply growth is extremely difficult, but one could always have depended on demand growth continuing to increase. Demand growth now is very much dependent on the emerging markets, and it's more dependent today on emerging market growth than it was in the, before the pandemic. So oil prices are still well bid and pushing up to the upper side of this range, and the range has been underway since the peak in 2008. So this range has been going for 14 years already, and we've seen ranges last longer. So there was, of course, a big peak in 1981, and it was 25 years before we really saw a break higher. But it looks increasingly likely that oil prices are going to continue to rise against a background where there is less investment and a recovering global economy fueled by money supply growth. And of course, if oil prices continue to rise, it contributes to the rising cost of production for all other commodities. And it's the major input for the vast majority of mining enterprises. So on the one hand, we have copper prices, which are right in the region of the previous highs, and there's been a consolidation underway for the last year. And there's an argument right now in the financial markets talking about supply. They're basically thinking that there was a supply deficit in 2021, and that there might be a supply surplus in 2022, maybe even into 2023. And obviously, everybody is looking at the post-pandemic experience, where we had this incredible advance in 2009 through 2011, and then a profound downtrend that basically saw the price of copper halve. So some people today are betting that that's what we have in future, that this post-pandemic surge isn't going to last. And then you have other people that are saying that no, we have a new demand growth driver that is at least equivalent and potentially larger than the accession of China into the WTO. And when you listen to the figures that are being thrown around by COP26, that 100 trillion is going to be required spent over the course of this decade, well, obviously that's a lot of money, and a lot of it is going to have to pour into supplying the world with increasing copper or the supply of copper, for the simple reason that all of the renewable energies sources, all of the automotive vehicles that are going to be produced with batteries, hybrid or otherwise, are extremely intense on copper demand. The very fact that you need tons of copper for every wind turbine, but then because they have to be spaced between each other and they have to transmit the electricity generated from their motors to a central hub, then there's a lot of cabling between them as well. So we're talking about significant investment in additional new demand growth for copper. And we can see that the copper companies continue to do well. So there's going to be a lot of investment in additional new supply. And we can see that Southern Copper has been ranging, well, had been ranging for the better part of 13 years and broke out. And now it's finding support at the previous highs. And that's the minimum condition to support the view that we're in a secular bull market. Then we can think about First Quantum, and they have assets in Zambia, which is one of the bigger exporters. They have assets elsewhere as well, and the price now is right in the region of the upper side of the range. Everybody is bullish about copper, and you have a couple of people that are attempting to be iconoclastic and thinking that prices are going to decline. But if prices decline, then you're going to see demand surge because it's going to be more accessible to deploy assets. So I suspect that if we do see a, I guess the way to think about it is the same kind of environment we had with lithium. Because we had the initial advance in lithium prices in 2011. Then we had a big decline because the supply increased before the demand. And then we've seen lithium prices rise by 6 times in the last year. So that's created a great deal of interest in companies that are supplying that lithium, like Orocobre, which is now Allkem in Australia, and the share has been trending higher in a really quite aggressive manner, but that's being fueled by demand for lithium, and the share is probably due a little consolidation in here. But it's also broken out of this extraordinarily long-term range. So we're in a new trending environment overall. Now, when we think about where is that copper going to come from, well, I thought that one of the more interesting presentations at the Future Minerals Summit was made by Ivanhoe. So Friedland is certainly viewed as a very strong promoter, and he did a fantastic job of talking up the demand growth drivers for copper. But it is in prospecting, which is, I think, much more important, everything that he said. The Typhoon system that Ivanhoe has produced. I talked to people at their desk and quizzed them about how it works. So I asked them about Australia, for example, because what has been clear about Australia is the incredible amount of resources that are sitting under the ground, and the vast majority of mining in Australia, with the obvious exception of the Pilbara, has just been surface. There aren't that many underground mines in Australia. And if you could then bring that kind of technology for prospecting, well, then you would be able to overcome a lot of the arguments against mining. But one thing that the chap from Ivanhoe said was that it was problematic to use this kind of technology in Australia because a lot of the rock is refractory. So it would bounce off the signals would bounce off it. So he did say that it works best in desert environments, but also in porphyry deposits. And porphyry deposits are the ones that miners tend to get really excited about because you get copper and gold. And everybody is well aware of just how high the grades can possibly be. So there's a strong likelihood that Ivanhoe is going to split off its Ivanhoe Electric hub, and then it's going to start selling its services on a royalty or a buy-in basis. But the innovation in geophysics that it represents is a game changer for the mining sector. It will reduce the cost of production. So that's a very significant factor. Now, it's not going to happen overnight, and it takes years to develop new mines. But I've been predicting that there would be some kind of innovation in prospecting. I thought that it would probably come from satellite telemetry because of the improvements in space technology, the declining cost of lift, and then the higher resolution that we're getting from cameras. But sending electric arcs through the ground from small drill bits and then using artificial intelligence to measure the resistance so that you can identify both the shape, extent, and size of deposits of copper, iron, gold, silver, manganese to depths of 2 miles. And that you don't need to drill prospective wells, or you don't need to drill, excuse me, prospective drill holes. That you can then scale up that kind of investment. Now, the reason that they were talking in Saudi Arabia is because Saudi Arabia and the Nubian Belt are unexplored. And there are ex very few regions in the world that are truly unexplored. The places that are unexplored are either going to be in that area or going to be across Russia and Canada and Greenland, where ice is receding. And these are going to be some of the places where you get the greatest prospecting going on. But if this technology is going to be suitable for the kinds of and the other thing that he did mention was that it was originally used in the prospecting for the Oyu Tolgoi mine in Mongolia, which has turned into the really are the biggest development in copper supply during the last bull market. What it also suggests is that the technology is well understood by the firm, and they've had it around for nearly 20 years. So now they're looking to commercialize it. And obviously, as soon as they start selling it, it will be copied. So they've been holding it internally, and that certainly helped to support the share. Now, it rallied on the announcement. In fact, it rallied ahead of the announcement, even though they banned their employees from trading in the share for 2 days prior to the to that meeting. And we may see some consolidation, but if copper prices remain anywhere in the $4 area, then revenue is going to continue to accrue to these companies. So when we look at copper miners ETF, for example, well then. We continue to see a recovery underway, and that's just for the broad sector overall. Well, these are recovering sectors, so you have the base effect, and that's helping to fuel continued demand. But when we think about money and credit, well, it's I think also important to pay attention to what's happening in China, because China's impulse. Credit impulse has been declining for the last year, and it went negative in March of last year, and now it's back in the region of the lows. And there's a clear cyclicality. It tends to come down for from the peak level around 10% growth to about a negative of 10% growth, and then it starts to go back up again. And we've seen that a large number of property developers have got into trouble. And that's not a mistake. That was by design. The Chinese government wants to try and squeeze speculation out of the property sector. Xi Jinping has been quite clear in stating, in plain English, well, I guess plain Chinese, that houses are for living in, not for speculation. So they're weighing on the sector. But what's, I think, particularly relevant here is that this index was updated at the end of November and it was just ticking higher. So when we then think about how are those property companies performing? Well, they went through a really difficult period, but the Shanghai Property Index is now back at the upper side of its range. Now, it did pull back this week, and we're getting consolidation going on right now. So it's not plain sailing just yet. And the vast majority of the companies in this index have some form of state ownership. So they're not the ones that are going to go bust. I think what we're seeing right now in China, the closest comparison to what that we have is what happened in India. Because India really squeezed the privately owned banks. And Yes Bank hasn't recovered from that experience. It's still in this very lengthy process of consolidation. And that's following a massive decline, and the owners basically being pushed out. But the state-owned banks were fine. So I think that's probably what we're also going to see in China, that it's companies like Evergrande and its ilk are going to eventually go bust. Or they'll be excised from the market entirely, or they'll be taken over by the larger state-owned firms, and leverage will decrease within the system. And the frenetic pace of development will begin to abate. And that's the primary reason why people are negative on copper. They think that the uncertainty surrounding the Chinese demand growth is very much focused on infrastructure development, and the deleveraging process is going to contribute to less demand for copper in 2022 and 2023. But if the credit impulse is bottoming, well, eventually we're going to see that China will have to start to loosen up on monetary and fiscal stimulus, because they don't want to have a property crash. And property prices have been falling for 4 months in a row. And the pace of the decline is starting to pick up. And since property has been the favored investment vehicle for the vast majority of Chinese citizens, well, they're obviously worried. And that's also having an impact on consumer demand growth for goods and services. So China is also then facing down the potential for the Omicron variant to play havoc with its zero COVID policy. And we're only about 2.5 weeks away from the beginning of the of well, first the New Year holiday and the beginning of the Winter Olympics. So they're going to be importing a lot of people, and there'll be a big crowds at these events. So it's obviously a some or it's an event and kind of a scenario where they're going to want to ensure that they don't have a big spread event. They may be able to contain it. Certainly, I think everybody visiting Saudi Arabia this week was worried about getting a negative PCR test before flying home again. But I don't know of anybody that got a positive one. So certainly, there is the possibility that the Winter Olympics can be it can go off without a hitch. But are they going to be able to contain the Omicron variant? Because the number of cases does continue to rise. And that's going to inhibit consumer demand for goods and services. So if we go back then and think about that money supply growth and central bank assets that we had right at the beginning of the broadcast, well, there's the real potential that it's going to continue to trend higher, but that the focus of attention is going to migrate away from the highly valued technology sector and potentially then back towards commodities and emerging markets. And of course, the big question is what happens with the dollar? Because the dollar tends to move in cycles. And it's cyclically, it is due a pullback. It's almost biblical in nature that you get 7 years in the up, you get 7 good years and 7 bad years. And we've had the 7 good years up to 2018, and that would suggest that when the dollar does eventually break, that it will break down from this range and it will not bottom until we get to a new low on the dollar index. But of course, that's assuming that the euro will rally. And that's obviously a big question. Because what we are at the moment is a period of competitive devaluation. There is no country wants a strong currency. But some need a weaker currency more than others. And Europe has also been in this type of situation where there's been a Japanization factor going on. So Japan hasn't been able to raise interest rates for at least two cycles. Europe tried to raise interest rates. And I think that's the most important factor, that when we think about what's going to happen in terms of money and rates, I think Europe gives us a good example of what to anticipate from the Federal Reserve. After the credit crisis in 2009, they cut rates aggressively, and they were worried about inflationary pressures in 2011, and they raised rates twice. And they had such a negative impact on the economy, and then, of course, there was the sovereign wealth crisis that they had to cut rates to zero. And they've been at zero since the beginning of 2016, but it's been more than 10 years since the ECB has been able to raise rates. And they have been categorically stating that they think that inflationary pressures are transitory, so they're not going to raise rates. So now we have the Federal Reserve. And they thought that inflation was transitory, and they've been waiting to raise rates. Now they're at a position where they are engaged at present in tapering. They anticipate raising rates this year, and they're also talking about balance sheet runoff. Well, the one thing we know for certain, and we have ample examples of it from the ECB, because they took a trillion out of circulation and caused a deflationary environment in the middle of the last decade. And when the Federal Reserve tried to engage in balance sheet runoff, well, then it contributed to significant volatility in 2018. So we saw Jay Powell just last week, after a 5% pullback on Wall Street, starting to walk back the anticipation that balance sheet runoff would happen anytime soon. But the other, I think, important point is that I think it's very likely that interest rates are going to have a very difficult time rising in this environment. And this is something that I think is beginning to be appreciated by investors now, because the spread between the 10-year and the 2-year is at around 81 basis points. And it was impossible for the spread to get up to the upper side of this cyclical highs that we saw in 92, 2003, and 2010 through 14 because of where interest rates were. But it did get up to about 1.5%, and now we're seeing a meaningful contraction. Now, when this yield curve becomes inverted, it generally is a lead indicator that's reliable for future trouble and a future recession. In the interim, between when the yield curve peaks and when it becomes inverted below zero, you tend to get bull markets, and we've certainly had a bull market so far. Well, the fact that it's still positive would suggest that Wall Street is going to bottom reasonably soon, but it's going to be very much dictated by what happens in terms of yields. Because the 5-year yield, which is very similar to the duration of the Federal Reserve's debt, continues to trend higher. Now, it's been in a funk and declining since 1981, and every major high has been lower than the last. And that would suggest that the peak may be quite close, that we may get yields up to about 2%, and then they'll probably start to come back down again. We have to start thinking about what are the sources of inflation. Well, money supply growth is obviously one of the major contributors to inflationary pressures. But the excess demand growth during the pandemic and the devil may care way of living, where people simply gave up waiting and are front-loading their purchases, and thinking that it's that you only live once, so you might as well enjoy life. That's obviously contributed to a great deal of demand for goods that completely outstripped the ability of companies to manufacture and ship. But the other important point is that any further meaningful appreciation in yields is going to have a significant knock-on effect on the ability of the US government to service their debt. The size of the national debt went up by 25% during 2020, and the yield has now fully unwound the compression. So the cost of servicing the debt actually went down for most countries in 2020, and now it's going up. So it's logical to think that the cost of servicing the debt will increase by 25% this year if yields remain high. And that's going to inhibit the ability of the government to continue to spend, or it's going to necessitate a quicker pace of money supply growth. But of course, that would imply that the Federal Reserve will have to walk back their quantitative tightening agenda. And so far, we're not there yet. So, in the short term, it's likely we're going to have volatility in asset prices, most particularly on Wall Street. And as long as these yields continue to push higher, well, it's going to weigh on the companies that don't have profits and that don't have cash at work in the market. So, the IPO ETF is breaking downwards, and the SPAC index has continued to trend lower. And these are the weakest portions of the market because they're the most interest rate sensitive. Well, then we can also think about the solar sector. The entire argument around solar is that you get long-term returns once you put in the solar panels. But what you're effectively doing is concentrating the capital intensive portion of the purchase into the beginning rather than the end, or spreading out the payments over time. So, as interest rates rise, then the logic of that business model becomes less compelling. In other words, solar and wind shares are probably going to struggle as long as interest rates are rising, whereas the commodities are doing well because investors are beginning to price in the potential that eventually the Federal Reserve is going to have to print more money. And this expectation that we had at the end of last year that there were going to be four interest rate hikes this year is fanciful. It's extremely unlikely the Federal Reserve is going to be able to do that because after even two interest rate hikes, the market will pull back by 20%. And then the big question will be, are we going to have the Powell put exactly like we had in 2018? And we already saw some walking back of their hawkishness after a 5% pullback. So it's likely then that the dollar is going to eventually roll over because of the necessity for the Federal Reserve to print money. And that's also why gold is firming. So gold prices have been ranging for the last 9 months, and this has been an orderly consolidation. Now, it has been maddeningly frustrating for the majority of traders. And I've been sitting with my gold position for months, and I've been sharing in that frustration. But I just don't see a scenario where gold prices are going to have a big decline. This continues to look like a consolidation in the region of the all-time peak, and that eventually the dollar is going to break lower. And when it does so, gold prices are going to reflect that devaluation in the currency. Now, I think it's also particularly relevant to pay attention to some of the currencies that did worst in the last decade. So the Brazilian real lost 70% of its value, and it's just beginning to steady from that 6 level. The Russian ruble also declined in a very meaningful fashion and lost 70% of its value from the peak in 2008. And of course, there are geopolitical tensions with Russia, so it's a more risky environment. But Brazil's a pure commodity play. The country's finances do better when commodity prices are strong, and they don't do well when commodity prices are weak. And the price has been holding around this 80 level for the last 5 years. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we should see the market do better. And when we think about the Brazilian stock market, well, it did spectacularly well, up nearly 1800% in the bull market from 2002 to 2008. So we see that there's large numbers of commodities, particularly industrial resources, that are breaking higher. But I think the experience with nickel is one of the most important to highlight, because prices are just breaking out, and it's cleared the 20,000 level on a sustained basis for the first time since 2012. But the reason it's happening is because China has inhibited the supply of nickel from pig nickel from Indonesia. They developed a way of supplying nickel from very low-grade sources that was very energy intensive and carbon intensive. So with the supply problems for energy this winter in China, then they cut down the supply of nickel from pig nickel, and that's allowed the price to ramp higher. That's despite the fact that, and of course we have Tesla buying nickel supply, but there are also lithium iron phosphate batteries that are now becoming more of a factor within the global electric vehicle market because they were successfully rolled out in China. They don't have as much range, but they do last longer, and they're cheaper to manufacture. So we have lithium iron and phosphate. Lithium prices have been surging, but phosphate's a rare commodity, and one of the reasons why Ma'aden has done so well is not only because it's government financed, but they have discovered significant phosphate in Saudi Arabia. So the share has done particularly well over the course of the last year, and that was an awfully big upward dynamic we saw in the last week. So we can think about the performance of various emerging markets. And one of the reasons why people weren't really involved with emerging markets over the course of the last decade was because of the uncertainty around the currency. But Saudi Arabia's currency is pegged, and the index is breaking out of a 12-year base formation. And it's not just about oil, it's about banking and mining as well. And they have every intention of building the downstream industries for lithium production, and they own half of Lucid Group, and Lucid will be building a factory in Saudi Arabia, and they intend to go out and source lithium, process manganese, process phosphate domestically. So that's also going to obviously create a boom in chemicals production and in fertilizer production. And Mosaic's CEO was also speaking at the Future Minerals Conference, but he was talking about the manufacturing process for phosphate, and that it's not simply about just digging it out of the ground, and that it does require an advantage in energy prices. So Saudi Arabia has got a demographic dividend in its future. They have 30 million people, and the vast majority of them are younger than 25, and they need to find gainful employment, but opportunities for those young people to achieve their productive capacity. And the enthusiasm those kids have, it's infectious. So I really was inspired. But I'm also thinking about the social changes, because the breaking of a calcified social structure does not come without challenges. And Saudi Arabia is obviously a country that's known for conservatism. So obviously, what's happening today is a really profound change. And they obviously have a reputation internationally that they're attempting to reform. But they're certainly also attempting to invest early to become a dominant player in the green revolution. And they believe they can achieve that because of the low cost of energy that they have, whether that is going to be renewable or fossil fuel oriented. And the stock market index is completing a base formation. And because of the dollar and the dollar peg, it means that the nominal price of the stock market could appreciate. But we're starting to see that commodity related assets are breaking out all over. And countries like India, where you have a demographic dividend as well, and you have the population where half of them are younger than 25, well, they have their own challenges. And embracing the productive capacity of its young people is an enormous challenge. Now, this is in US dollars, and all the charts that I've looked at so far have been in US dollars. But what's, I think, particularly interesting for India is that the chart pattern doesn't change all that much recently, even though we put it back into rupees. And that's because the rupee has been quite steady. And the rupee's lost 40% of its value in the last decade. So India is increasingly becoming a destination for speculative interest because of its growth rate. And it's at the beginning of a new credit cycle. So banking there is going to become more of a prosperous business. And the growth of the consumer is likely to persist on a secular basis. And demand for energy in particular is going to trend higher. And of course, a lot of that energy is going to come from fossil fuels for at least the next decade and potentially longer. And that is despite the fact that India is investing heavily in solar in particular. So we have an evolving secular bull market right across the emerging markets. I think it's also it's important to be country specific because the emerging markets ETF from MSCI has been ranging for most of the last 12 years, and it's struggling because of the overweight in China. And when we look at the emerging markets ex-China, well, then it's starting to pop up right at the top of the search bar because plenty of people are looking at it, and it is outperforming. It's already at a new high and it's bouncing right now. So ex-China is likely to continue to do well. But if China does engage in more fiscal and monetary stimulus, then that should lend some support to the stock market. But so far, there's not a lot of support coming through for the stock market. So the big question really is how much pain is China willing to tolerate? Without China, global money supply continues to increase. With China, it will accelerate. And that will then contribute to, I think, a significant advance right across the emerging markets. China is obviously a regional heavyweight in Asia and particularly for Africa, So, with more money and credit being produced by China, then that's going to be a significant tailwind for the region. And of course, it will also be a significant tailwind for commodity producers. So the ASX 200 is right in the region of the all-time peaks and just consolidating. And it's very heavily weighted by both banks and commodities. So obviously, banks are very dependent on the low interest rate environment persisting. I suspect that we're going to have a difficult environment raising rates everywhere because there are concentrations of credit stimulus in various parts of the world. Even though oil prices, excuse me, even though oil prices continue to rally, shipping prices are coming back down. And the demand growth for goods in particular will eventually moderate. And housing prices, which contribute a lot to inflationary pressures, can't rise by 10% a year indefinitely. So that will also moderate. And central banks will leap on any decrease in inflationary pressures as an excuse to delay raising rates. The rationalization of the quantity of debt that was increased in 2020 is a significant headache for most central banks. So they're going to try and delay that. They're going to try and run off the debt. They're going to try and raise interest rates before we come to a maturity wall. But I think one of the most important things is that despite the high yield sector rolling over, it hasn't broken down. And a good part of the reason why high yield spreads remain contained is because they went through a massive refinancing process in 2020. So there's no imminent need for refinancing. So that's generally the time of most uncertainty for high yield. And if high yield spreads are contained, and despite the fact that yields continue to rise, I continue to think that this is not an inevitable trend, and eventually the Federal Reserve will have to walk back its belief that it can just raise rates anytime it wants. There is a real potential that the USA in this cycle is going to experience the same phenomenon that the Europeans experienced, and that they are going to have a shock, that they are going to be unable to raise rates anytime they want. And if that's the case, then it's going to be negative for the dollar, and it's going to be extremely beneficial for emerging markets and for commodities generally. And I think that's the primary rationale for a secular bull market. So I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.